You Alone, My Maker and My King. Music from Christina on a Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning, 12 minutes past the hour, and we're joined by Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, also the Executive Director thereof. Doug comes to us from Columbia, Maryland, where today it's what, sunny? I hope?
We're going to probably push 70 today, hopefully,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, all right. That's good news. Okay. That's terrific news. And we've got sunshine, and we'll be near 70, too. You might as well come over to East Dakota and spend some time. You wouldn't lose a thing.
I could feel very comfortable over there with that temperature. I love your landscape up there in central Minnesota.
It is pretty around here. It really is. But then you got cherry blossoms out in your area, don't you?
Well, we had some rain all day yesterday, so I don't know how much of that is left. But, yeah, it peaked this past weekend.
Mm-hmm. This is a big tourist time for Washington, D.C.
Oh, I tell you, they had gridlock, and you could not get within 5 miles of Washington, D.C., the mall.
Yeah, really?
On the weekend. It was unbelievable.
They still have that beltway where you got to go round and round and round.
And there are very few feeder streets that go in, and everybody and their brother wanted to see the blossoms, and so note to self, if you're going to go to watch the cherry blossoms, make sure you take the metro in.
What is the good time to go to Washington to see the monuments and the museums and all the rest of this stuff? Is there a good time?
I would say early to mid-May. The kids haven't gotten out of school yet, but it's probably going to be at least mid-70s, 78, 80. Mm-hmm. But the humidity hasn't shown up
yet. Yeah, I was going to say, I remember it as a humid area. Yeah, when I was there. So
I think I was there in March or April, it seems like. The snow was off the ground. The cherry blossoms hadn't shown up yet, but it was, and there weren't a lot of people, but I was in the middle of the week. That was the other part of it, yeah.
I was pleased to hear Andre Crouch.
Ah, well, yeah, yeah.
Which reminds me, do you ever play Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir?
We got some Damaris Carbaugh, but not with the choir behind her. I'm looking for some of that stuff yet. Yeah.
Yeah, because in the early 2000s, the BTC, the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir, they were my absolute favorite.
Outstanding. We'll find some for you. I'm going to go music hunting today, and I will do that. I also have to get some Michelle Legrand for a listener who wanted a Brian song. So I'll be on the music hunt today, and we'll put the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir in there. We should have some of them. We need that. See, I remember being in Washington. Now, this would have been 1969, 1970. It was Marine Corps days, and I was stationed down at Quantico in Virginia. And much to my chagrin, portions of the city of Washington, D.C. were off limits to us. Just imagine being an officer in the United States Marine Corps and large areas of your nation's capital are off limits because it was too dangerous. The black areas. Is that still a concern there?
Wow.
I mean, if you go into certain parts of what they call Southeast, nothing's changed.
Okay. Same. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'd hope we'd fix that by now. Say, Doug Greenwald brings us a great conversation every Wednesday, and we typically talk about biblical context, historic context. We kind of take you back to the first century in Israel and go over scriptural accounts, and we try to understand it the way those people would have understood it, receive the information with the same kind of connections and fabric that they would have seen all this information in. And Doug, when you were here a few weeks ago, you delivered the Sunday lesson. We need a better name than sermon or lesson for this. It was an experience. You were just awesome up there.
It was a message, I guess.
Well, it is. It's a message, and it's a profound message, and a much more profound chapter in Jesus' ministry than I ever thought before. And this is when he sailed across to the other side. Maybe you can tell us about that. Now, for those of you that have Bibles handy, you might want to open it up to Luke chapter 8, or is it Mark chapter 4?
Either one, although
slight difference
is going to be on Luke 8.
Okay.
But I've got to say it, what are we into, our fourth year now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, Jim, you still haven't learned to set the stage for these passages?
Uh-oh. I'll take notes.
You asked me to go and open up Luke 8. I can't do that.
No.
Got to set the stage.
Well, that's true.
So
being taken to task.
Well,
the one I love to hear is, Doug, could you set the stage for the passage that we will consider?
Okay, thank you. I'll remember that.
after you set the contextual stage.
Well, we don't just start by reading, do we? I know that, but I wanted people who are listening to have that handy, because they'll want to kind of go along with us here. But go ahead, warm us up with this.
Well, do you remember when Jesus went back to his hometown,
Nazareth,
on a Shabbat, and was asked to read from the Isaiah scroll in Luke 4?
And he sat in the Moses seat, and I remember that.
And people his audience happy. By what he implied and said. But among other things, he said he had come to set the prisoners free. And I like to call that those five phrases that he did a cut and paste from Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, dropped a couple of phrases out, imported a phrase from Isaiah 58, 6, arranged them in five statements in an inverted parallelism. And basically, I call that his rescue manifesto. That's where he said why he came and what he was going to do. And in the middle of that was the phrase to set the prisoners free. So we wouldn't be surprised, would we, to see him set yet another prisoner free?
No, this was some kind of prisoner. This was I can't think of anybody else in Scripture like this.
This is going to be demonic possession, and if there's a Richter scale of demonic possession of 0 to 10, this is probably 13.5. This is one phenomenal rescue. But that's just the backdrop here, and we need to remember what his name, Yeshua, stands for. The Semitic meaning of that is the Lord rescues. Mm-hmm. He is God's rescuer. So rescuing people from unthinkable, unbearable, incomprehensible situations is what he does. And that's basically what he's been doing since Luke 5.
Now, how far along in his ministry is this? Because I remember the wedding at Cana was early. That was like the first week with the disciples. And now he's done some healing and some teaching. He's spoken at his hometown synagogue, ruffled some feathers there with that, almost got himself killed, but they couldn't do that. Where is he now? Where along the timeline are we?
You know, it's never precise to answer some of those questions unless there's a reference to Passover. Mm-hmm. But I would think he's still within the first year of his ministry, because if my memory is correct here, we haven't had a Passover, the first Passover reference yet. So that would put it within the first year.
And he was training his disciples intensely during this period.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a segue to another piece of context at 5,000 feet we have to have in view before we jump into our ground level passage here, is that he has been remaking his disciples. I think it's more appropriate to say he's been detoxing his disciples from everything that their observant Judaistic culture has taught them. Their view of God, their view of Gentiles, their view of prostitutes, their view of tax collectors, their view of prayer, their view of righteousness. I mean, he is literally detoxing them from everything they thought they knew to be true, because he realizes all of the way they were thinking is an impediment to their grasping, let alone falling in love with the kingdom of God. So one way to look at what's going on here is he's detoxing his disciples in the process of remaking them to be kingdom disciples. And he has a fascinating strategy about how he does it, at least in Luke. And that's the book that we're going to be primarily in. He doesn't give a lot of lectures. He doesn't give his disciples a lot of teaching. He doesn't call them and take them off on a retreat weekend. He just immerses them in one shock therapy cultural experience after another. And Luke captured the pedagogy, the teaching technique here of Jesus, in the very first verse of Acts, which he also wrote. He calls this do and teach. He says, Theophilus, the previous scroll I wrote about everything I saw Jesus do and teach. So Jesus' strategy, his pedagogy, his way of remaking people to be the kind of disciples that he intends them to be, it seems to be primarily to immerse them in very challenging situations that they would never expect, that they're not used to, that they're not comfortable with. And then later on, he's going to talk about it. And that's do and teach. And that's in contrast to most of what we prefer to do in Western evangelicalism, which is teach and maybe do. We really turn the thing backwards. But if changing deeply entrenched paradigms is the purpose, is the task, is the objective in view, as a rule of thumb, words, lectures, exhortations don't cut it. You need to place people in experiences that are so contradictory to their assumptions, their norms, what they hold to be true, that it forces them to rethink their previous positions. And so we wouldn't be surprised to see Jesus once again immerse his disciples in another shock therapy experience. That's what he's been doing ever since he started with them in Luke 5. So that's another observation. Yet another observation contextually is to look at passages from the perspective of the three covenants, the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the Mosaic covenant. There are six aspects to those three covenants. And it is a fascinating way to watch Jesus. Everything he does in the Gospels, he does it from the perspective of redeeming one or more of those six aspects of those three covenants. And so we wouldn't be surprised here to see him further redeem the Abrahamic covenant that Abraham's seed will be a blessing to all peoples. And up until now, Jesus has just been functioning in the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, which is observant Judaism. And so this is the first time he's going to leave the relatively friendly confines of observant Judaism and go on the offensive against his enemy, his adversary, Satan. And so that's part of the backdrop here, contextually, of what's going on, what set the stage for the actual encounter now that Luke records for us in his eighth chapter.
He did everything so intentionally. It's almost like, did anything happen by accident? And he's in such control.
No, but that does remind me of our definition of accident, coincidence these days. It's God's providence done anonymously.
I like that.
And as you were talking, Doug, I've often thought, and as a slight, small, teeny, tiny digression, and that there's no way I'm ever going to convince somebody that doesn't think politically like me unless it gets so bad, so awful. They're going to live with their consequences of their cockamamie rules and regulations and beliefs that are just so out there. There's no way they're ever going to change their mind unless they sink into the living with the consequences of what they're suggesting. And just about everything from, free and open abortion to, absolute minimum wage for everybody, or guaranteed wage for everybody. But, it's resonating and ringing a bell. I just have to figure out some way to do it without the rest of us suffering.
Well, this will be an immersion experience for the disciples, though, as they head.
Yeah, but I mean, what you're saying is one of those aha moments again. Mm-hmm. You've done it again.
Well, there's some interesting political analogies here. It's pretty hard to reason and use logic to take an entrenched Democrat and convert them into an independent or a Republican, right? I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Right.
But if we've had Democratic regimes for 20 years and suddenly we're in the Great Depression again, maybe that will shake them up enough to realize that the fundamental assumptions of economic policy that undergird, let's say, the Democratic philosophy are flawed. And maybe now they'll be open to looking at it a different way. But you're absolutely right. When you deal with entrenched paradigms, words, logic, and reason generally doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
You have to be immersed in an experience that just totally challenges everything you thought was right and true.
Yeah.
So that's Jesus's technique. And to a certain extent, we get a small glimpse of this today when we take affluent kids from suburbia and they go on a 3-week mission trip to Uganda or something like that. It's their first exposure that everyone doesn't live like they do. it's their first exposure that there is poverty in the world and there is hunger. And, you know, not that that changes all those teenage kids, but it does affect some. But no amount of lectures and homilies and sharing in small groups, you know, back in the United States would really penetrate them with that truth, with that a reality. So Jesus's technique of do and teach, not teach and maybe do, is still sound, is still wired into the fabric of the universe when it comes to accomplishing change in the lives of people. And we would be well advised to embrace that pedagogy with much more intent and a seriousness in our body life today.
So Jesus knew what was going to happen. He was prepared for it, and he was intentional about going there at that particular time, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. In fact, we can say, to quote Paul, in terms of the demoniac, his fullness of time has come. Absolutely. Before creation was even conceived, this act at this moment in time was part of the master plan.
So they were on the northwest shore of Galilee, and he'd been teaching and healing with the 12.
Well, yeah, as it picks up in Luke's 8th chapter, verse 22, one day Jesus said to his disciples, now we also learn from the parallel passage in Mark here, this is now very late in the afternoon, because they shove off in the early morning, basically. Mm-hmm. The disciples have been with Jesus all day, standing around watching and listening as he taught and as he healed. And the end of the day comes, and they probably think it's time to punch out. The day's over. And Jesus says, let's go over to the other side of the lake. Now, there's a code word there. It's the phrase other side. This is observant Judaism. There are lots of things you can't do or say without becoming ritually unclean. And so one of the things you cannot do is mention the word Decapolis, which is on the other side of the lake. It happens to be, if we're looking at the Sea of Galilee from a Google map, from south to north, the Decapolis is in the southeastern quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. So, you know, we have to sail from the northwest to the southeast. And just to pick up a little bit what the Decapolis is, it's the last vestiges of all those Macedonian city-states that Alexander the Great imported into this region after his conquest in 332 BC as part of his subjugation strategy. And, you know, starting with the Maccabean Revolt in like 167 BC, they began to purge the vestiges of Greek city-states and Greek occupation from the land. It took them a little while to do that. And these 10 cities, Deca, 10, polis, for Greek for city, these 10 cities are the last vestiges of that. And it's the center of Greco-Roman lifestyle in this land. It's just across the lake. And so this is where an observant Jew understands is the land of evil. This is the world of hedonism. This is where if it looks good, touch it. If it feels good, do it. If it tastes good, eat it. And to the Jewish worldview, this land of hedonism, this Greco-Roman world, is Satan's domain. He's the chief operating officer here. And they, as observant Jews, are absolutely forbidden from ever setting foot on that soil. Okay? So when Jesus says, get in the boat, we're going to the other side, what do you think their first reaction is?
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah, well, that's putting it mildly.
I thought
can't
I was
believe
done
what
for
I just
the
heard. We can't do this. And Jesus, you know we can't do this. We know you can't do this. Would you say it again? Because we must have misheard what you just said. Yeah. Plus, you're just about to punch out for the day, and now you realize you're not punching out at all. you're going to somewhere where you're not supposed to go. You also know, because you're most of them are sailors, that even with decent winds, it's going to be a five-hour sail, okay? Which means most of the time you're going to be sailing at night. And if we go back to the Mark passage, there's another colloquialism there. Jesus says, and they got in the boats just as he was, which is a strange phrase, just as he was. But what that idiomatically means is now, not even as soon as possible, ASAP. Jesus is saying, get in the boats and get in the boats now, okay? No time to grab a snack, no time to leave a message with the family. Get in the boat and get in the boats now. We're going to the other side. So this is very unexpected. This is something you're forbidden to do. And if I let my imagination run just a little bit wild here, I wonder if Andrew and John and Peter sort of caucus off to the side here and say, is it time for an intervention with Yeshua? Do we have to call his bluff on this one? Do we have to actually confront him and say, this is one thing we're not going to do? Okay. Well, of course, that's not going to happen. That only happens in our Western mind because they're his disciples. They have to do what he says. That's the commitment they've made. That's what a disciple is about, among other things. And so into the boats they go. And how happy of campers, fishermen, do you think these guys are at this moment in time?
I think they're probably getting a little surly.
Yeah, right. So they shove off, and they start tacking in the winds. Now, we got to deal with the winds here. We're in a wind transition period of time. The prevailing westerlies are going to stop, you know, about as the sun goes down, and there's going to be a temperature reversal here in this semi-arid land, and we're going to start to pick up prevailing easterly winds as we go deeper into the evening. So leaving the shore at this moment in time, you're leaving with fairly weak winds because they're in transition. Maybe it might take 6 or 7 hours, you know, total elapsed time. But anyway, you start sailing. You're not making very good progress because of the wind transition. Night starts to fall. And then the winds start picking up from the east as the east-west wind transition continues to unfold. Wait a minute here. These winds are getting stronger and stronger. And then they really get strong. And then they get violent. And we pick up the text.
If I can interrupt for just a second, you know, they were using... They were using old square rig sails with no spinnaker and you know, just the rudder. And so the good thing about that is once you get out in front of a trailing wind, and in this particular case they would be, they're gonna take off. The wind is gonna pull them right along. But the danger is they have no control. You can have the biggest rudder in the world, and you can just barely steer the boat. You know, you've got to keep pulling the sail up and down and up and down. Now, if it was a spinnaker arrangement, but that wasn't invented for another couple of centuries, then they could control the boat. But this way, it just hauled the sails up and hang on.
That's a really helpful observation. Wow. And let's add a little more, to that. If we actually had a map here, we're sailing from Capernaum southeast to Garagusa. It's a place called Kersey today. You can actually visit it. And so we're sailing on a diagonal, if you will, southeast, and we're dealing with easterly winds when we start out, and then we're dealing with westerly winds when we start out, and then we have to transition to easterly winds. So assuming that we get a pretty good blow as we leave, those westerly winds die out and the easterly winds pick up. And to pick up your understanding here, we've only got one sail. If you look at an easterly wind blowing at somebody who's sailing southeast, the intent here is to push you away from the eastern shore.
Yep. Right.
Okay? Yep. That's literally what's happening. It's just become harder and harder to get to the other side. And so we pick up the story here. So they got into the boats and set out. As they sailed, Jesus fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke Jesus, saying, "Master, Master." In Mark, they say, "Don't you care about us?" But it says, "We're going to drown." And Jesus got up and rebuked the winds and the raging waters. Now, you're experienced fishermen, at least some of you are. You've seen winds like this before, and no problem. We can handle it. But the intensity keeps ratcheting up. And say, "Well, we haven't seen too many winds like this, but, you know, about 4 years ago, there was one, and we managed to survive that." And suddenly the wind gets even worse than that. And so these seasoned professional fishermen, for whom fishing is their core competency, now have come to the conclusion that they're about to die. How you feeling? I mean, you weren't in favor of this trip from the get-go, and now you're going to die.
Gone from bad to worse. About ready to grab the lifeboat.
We really should have done the intervention that we were talking about. We never really should have gotten into these boats.
I knew it.
Yeah. I knew it, exactly. I knew it. Oh, I knew it. Man. Why didn't I stand for what I believed to be true?
Stepped in it again. Oh, man.
So, they wake Jesus up. When you're utterly desperate, might as well wake Jesus up, right?
That's a good idea, yep.
Of course, why they didn't go to him from the get-go, we'll just leave that question there. Mm-hmm. But that's because they're like us, right? We can handle it. I'll take care of it.
Sure, we know what we're doing.
I only bring God in if somehow I can't deal with it anymore, if somehow it gets totally out of control. But let me handle it. So Jesus gets up, and this is a fascinating word. He rebukes the wind. Now, why does he have to rebuke the wind?
That's always struck me as an odd choice of words, but that's what he did.
He created the wind. He was there in Genesis when creation was formed. He made the wind. He doesn't have to rebuke that which he made. Nature is his.
Now, there's something else at work here, I suspect.
There is something else at work here. Any thoughts? Well,
somebody didn't want them to get to the southeast
times past,
side.
We've talked about remez, R-E-M-E-Z. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
A deliberate hearkening back to something that everyone knows to be true rabbinical. And for which no further explanation is needed.
A rabbinical teaching technique.
Yep. And remez come in two forms, verbal and action. And I would suggest to you, these disciples who know their Old Testament cold, okay, that's their educational process, see this as a demonic wind. And you know what? It is a demonic wind. That's why Jesus has to rebuke it. Satan has hijacked nature for his own adversarial purposes to blow these guys off from and away from the eastern shore. And so Jesus rebukes the hijacking of the wind. And the reason I would suggest it's an action remez, because they remember Hosea 12:1, which talks about the wicked winds from the east, from the evil empires, okay? Mm. And they certainly see the Decapolis as an evil empire. They see it as Satan's domain. They realize they're going on the offensive to invade Satan's territory. They expect Satan to resist. Of course he's going to resist. And they see this as a demonic wind.
Well, Jesus,
that helps
Jesus,
us understand.
Let me insert just that I'm thinking as a disciple here now, to see Jesus do that would have like opened a whole new chapter in the book. Now the veil would have come off their eyes. Now we're in for something we'd never experienced before.
This is a showdown at the OK Corral in their eyes, okay? Mm-hmm. And we need to remember they were not with Jesus on his 40 days of temptation. They are not aware of the fact that Jesus has already established his authority over the adversary. Okay? And so that's their faith question. When Jesus says he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters, the storm subsided, the water was calm, And Jesus asked his disciples, where is your faith? That's the nature of the faith question. Don't you know I have authority over the adversary? And the answer is no, they don't. And that's what's got them spooked, okay? They had no idea how this thing is going to turn out, and they could literally die. And I think we're going to have to pause our story here. We're only halfway across the lake, but just a couple of observations. When we read the detail of the account here, not only does the wind immediately stop, but the waves cease. Now, you guys live up in lake country in central Minnesota, and you know that when a wave gets set in motion from the wind, it keeps going until it hits the beach somewhere on a shore. And so we have a phenomenal miracle here already, is violent waves suddenly become flat in a nanosecond, rather than carrying on for another 10 or 15 minutes until they all make themselves to the western shore. So interesting goings on here. And in fear and amazement, the disciples ask one another, who is this then? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. Wow. He actually, Satan has to obey him. This is new news for these guys. And we'll pause our story here. But if the wind is no longer blowing, how are you going to get to the remainder of your journey and get to the other side?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to sail anymore.
New task.
I would use my trolling motor.
I love you Westerners and the way you project your paradigms onto the text. It's just.
But you're suggesting they don't have one?
Even Rude didn't come up till 1910.
Yeah. Doug, we can pick this up next week, I hope. I don't want to leave them out there in the lake forever. So we'll pick this up next week.
Well, no. Get the oars, guys, and start rowing.
Yeah, you got to roll.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm going to get you involved in this ministry one way or another, and that's maybe where we ought to pick it up next week.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times in Columbia, Maryland, just right on the edge of Washington, D.C. The website is preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to them from our website at Broken Road Radio, and you can do that anytime. Explore what they have to offer. It's an immense, it's a wealth of resources for your church and your small groups and Bible studies. And next week, we'll continue with that voyage across the Sea of Galilee and see what's waiting on the other side. Doug, thanks so much. Shalom.
Thanks, guys.
Shalom, Doug.